'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The feed pipes were synced up to iTunes with care, in hopes that the Jodcast in time would be there.
The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of nebulae danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
When from the computer arose such a pinging, I sprang from my chair to see what was singing. Away to the PC as fast I could go, I minimized Minesweeper and loaded the show.
The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the lustre of midday to objects below. When what to my wondering ears should appear but a poem to open the Jodcast so dear.
With a New Zealand accent so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be our Nick. He spoke all his verse and then handed it on, and onwards it travelled through everyone.
Now David, now Stuart, now Megan and Ian, and Roy Smits and Tim, with his voice watch they lean. To the top of the show, to the top of it all. Now start it up, move it on, let's have a ball.
And there then the music began to be played. I knew the astronomy was well on its way. So then to my software the knowledge it flew, and into my ears as it now does to you.
The Jodcast. Season's greetings from Megan Argo, David Ault, Stuart Lowe, Ian Morrison, Tim O'Brien, Nick Rattenbury, and Roy Smits. The Jodcast. Yule issue. Hello and welcome to the final Jodcast episode for 2008. I'm Nick Rattenbury and with me is Stuart Lowe.
Hi Nick, hi everybody.
Yeah, so it's been a fantastic year, and thank you very much to our Jodcast audience for listening to us throughout the year, and hello to all our new audience members who have started listening to us recently.
Do you realise, Nick, that that's nearly 3 years we've done of the Jodcast?
It seems longer. It seems so much longer. Yes, as of the next episode, the January 1st episode, which may or may not come out exactly on January 1st, but
we'll try our best.
The January episode, we will be 3 years old. So thank you very much to everybody who has supported us over the years.
And with this being our just before Christmas episode, it's the end of term here at the Jodcast. So we've not wearing school uniform.
No, we're in mufti, and we've got
we're in what?
Mufti. Did you not use that expression?
No, that sounds quite dodgy.
Mufti. Not wearing uniform, you are wearing mufti. Civilian clothing.
I've never heard that before.
You've never heard that before?
No.
So it's a very informal episode this time through. We have an interview with Philip Best about LOFAR, the low frequency array.
We have Christmas gift ideas for last minute buying.
We have your feedback.
But first, before all of that, let's talk about the Jodcast video.
Yes, the next two Jodcast videos were recorded earlier this year down at the Royal Observatory, Greenwich. We had a great time. The weather was absolutely spectacular. So if anybody is in any doubt about whether the weather can be good in England, do watch these videos. If nothing else, you'll see London under a perfect blue sky.
It is, as Nick said, we have two episodes rather than just one this time as a special Christmas bonus.
It's our gift from us to you.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Yeah. So please, if you are listening to this, do please get onto the website and take a look at the videos. Of course, we've gone into a lot of effort to expand what the Jodcast can do. We went down there with our fancy new camera kit and recorded some fantastic people talking about the longitude problem, how the longitude problem was solved using clocks. And the second episode is talking about the observatory itself and how it is moving on with its brand new planetarium. So do check out both those episodes. They'll be available online before Christmas.
And so moving on from an iconic and historic observatory to an observatory of the future, Nick went to talk to Philip Best about the low-frequency array.
So joining me now is Dr. Philip Best from the University of Edinburgh, and you're here to talk to us today about a problem with galaxies, particularly the number of galaxies. Tell us a little bit about the problem that we face.
This is a problem with something we call the galaxy luminosity function. So this is the number of galaxies that there are in the universe as a function of how bright they are. So the fact that what we observe is a large number of faint galaxies and a much smaller number of bright galaxies. Now with our models of galaxy formation, we can predict roughly how many galaxies there should be as a function of brightness, but historically, there's been a long-standing problem that we've never been able to get this to match quite what we observe.
So how do we actually observe these galaxies, the number of galaxies? We simply take a telescope and look towards direction of sky and count the number of bright and faint galaxies?
Yes, it's simply that. With a spectroscopic survey, so you can tell how far they are away. Some of the major surveys that have been carried out, like the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey or the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So you measure the galaxies, how many there are in a given volume of space that are bright and that are less bright.
Generally, we expect to see more faint galaxies than bright galaxies simply because they're going to be more further away. The volume is going to be larger further away.
Well, this is faint as in terms of the luminosity. So we observe more that appear faint, but this is actually faint as in that they're intrinsically less luminous, right. So they have sort of lower masses, lower numbers of stars makes them less luminous, and we observe more faint ones. This is a thing that we see when we look at galaxies at all wavelengths, in the optical, in the radio, in the X-rays. There's always more faint things than there are bright luminous objects.
Is this for a very good reason, or is this just the way it is?
Well, largely this is the way it is. This is about how galaxies form and how structure forms in the universe through the coming together of dark matter. So dark matter particles, which are the particles that we can't see in the universe, not normal, what we call baryonic matter, the stuff you and I are made out of. These are the predominant form of mass in the universe is this dark matter, and this clumps together hierarchically, so it grows as the universe evolves from the early stages, coming together in initially in very small clumps, and then those small clumps merge up into larger and larger clumps. And this is something that we can model very well. The predominant force that's involved is just gravity, and we understand gravity very well indeed. And now In recent years, we've got a very good measurement for the cosmological parameters of the universe, the typical density of the universe, and the lambda, the so-called cosmological constant, and the Hubble constant as well. With all of these as inputs, we can model incredibly well how the dark matter should clump and grow together in the universe, and it forms in many more of the smaller clumps than the larger clumps. Now, the problem with galaxy formation is that the physics of baryonic matter, the sort of the gas and that makes stars and the particles that make you and I, this is much more messy. There's more than just gravity involved. There's many other forces that are involved in these, and many other processes that come in. I mean, you get this obviously it falls under gravity like the dark matter does to form clumps, form galaxies, but these then form stars. Stars reheat their environment, which heats the gas. At the end of a star's life, it goes off in a supernova, the most massive stars at least, and they feed back a lot of energy into their environments. And so there's a lot of, if you like, more messy physics that goes on in terms of galaxy formation. And this is the problem that's long faced astronomers, is how then to understand from our picture of how many dark matter clumps there are as a function of mass, how many galaxies there should be as a function of luminosity. And that's a much more difficult problem.
So we can simulate the universe in terms of the dark matter quite well. Well, we think we can do it quite well because we only are dealing with gravity and we understand gravity well. So there have been large simulations which will model a universe comprised mainly of dark matter, which is what we believe the universe is actually made up. And we let the thing run, little clumps of dark matter form, and then they coalesce, they merge, they get bigger, and we have a universe of dark matter structures. Now, what you're saying is that the formation of a galaxy is not just arising from a dark matter clump. There's going to be stars made of baryonic matter like you and I, influencing the way that the galaxy itself is being formed, not just through the action of gravity. To return to the problem that we mentioned right at the start, we have a mismatch between what these simulations are telling us about how many galaxies of what brightness should be and what we actually observe. Tell us a little bit more about exactly these differences.
Yes, so there's long been a problem from the very first galaxy formation models that were made, that essentially our models of galaxy formation predicted far too many faint galaxies or low luminosity galaxies and far too many bright high luminosity galaxies. But they actually got it about right for galaxies close to the mass of our own, things like the Milky Way. Now, the issue of the faint or low luminosity galaxies has been understood for some 10 or 20 years now, and this is simply because these galaxies are very small. They live in fairly shallow gravitational potential wells. So if they form some stars, and those early stars go off in supernova explosions, the energy that's pumped into the environment by those supernova feedback, as we often call it, is sufficient to heat a lot of the surrounding gas, or maybe even blow it out of the galaxy and prevent that from forming any new stars. And this means that these, at this low mass or low luminosity end, the galaxies, they don't grow as much as you might predict if the amount of light came out was simply proportional to the amount of mass that was there in dark matter. They end up to be a lot smaller, or there's a lot fewer of them because of this. Now, the bright end has been historically much more of a problem. For many, many years, nobody really understood why the models predicted so many more bright galaxies than we observed, why they weren't there in the real universe. And also, we found that the galaxies that we observed in the universe tended to be red, comprised of old stars without much ongoing star formation. The most massive galaxies is the elliptical galaxies. But whereas the models predicted these would be relatively blue, with a reasonable amount of ongoing star formation. And what was happening in the models was simply further gas was falling into the galaxies and forming stars. Young stars tend to look quite blue because they contain a lot of massive stars, which are short-lived, and massive stars are very luminous and blue, and they dominate the light of the galaxy. Whereas the old stars, if star formation stops, only the lower mass stars remain in the galaxy. The higher mass stars have died already, and these are much redder. Mm. So the models predicted that we should see ongoing star formation, which would carry on increasing the mass of the galaxy and make the galaxy appear bluer, and that was very much in contrast with observations.
What we saw were fewer galaxies, and those that we did see were red.
Yes, exactly. And so something was clearly missing in the models. And what the models simply did was to introduce some artificial way of stopping the gas cooling, but with no real physical understanding behind that. And what's changed in the last couple of years is people are beginning to get a feel for what might be causing this problem. And this is this particular class of galaxy called active galactic nuclei, in particular those that emit predominantly in the radio wave band, so they're often called radio sources, mostly low luminosity or relatively low luminosity radio sources. And these pump out energy into their environment as the active galactic nucleus. An active galactic nucleus is a black hole, a very massive black hole at the centre of a galaxy that's accreting material, and the sort of gravitational energy that's released as this material falls towards the black hole actually emits a copious amount of energy in terms of, it comes out to be about 10% of the rest mass energy of the falling material. The rest mass energy is just mc squared, where m is the mass of the particle, Einstein's famous equation. And much of this energy for these low luminosity radio sources comes out in the form of jets of material from emitted close to the black hole that travel out into the galaxy over very large distances, thousands of light years, in some cases even millions of light years. And this energy can then be deposited back into the galaxy, and it can reheat some of the gas that would otherwise cool and form stars, and stop it from doing so. And this is why we don't see the galaxies continuing to grow, and why we do see them to be red, because they have no recent star formation.
So in the same way that supernovae in the fainter galaxies blow out the gas in the galaxy, turning off star formation, so do the AGN in the more massive galaxies blow out the gas, or at least stop it from condensing into stars, and turns off the star formation.
Yes, that's right.
And we should point out that it's not just, we're not talking about, you know, a slight discrepancy here between what the models were telling us at the bright and the faint end of the galaxy number counts. Yeah. We're talking, there's a big difference, right, between what the models were predicting and what we actually saw.
Yes, I mean, if you take the model and you predict that the light simply follows the mass, then at the bright end we were out by a factor of 10 in terms of the number of galaxies we predict. Now, obviously, we've long known that this is wrong and there should be some missing physics. And as I say, little hand-waving tweaks have been put into the models to make this right. And what's coming now is the physical understanding of what's causing those tweaks.
So through the addition of some messy astrophysics into our models, have we achieved a correlation? Have we achieved a match to what we observe?
Yes. So the models have now, since about 2006, they've put in this. Now, I should say that many of these models have to implement these messy astrophysics, as we call it, in fairly simplified ways if we want to model the whole of galaxy evolution. And since about 2006, sort of simple prescriptions for how radio AGN feedback might work have been incorporated. And indeed, they now do predict galaxy luminosity functions and many other properties of the galaxies and their distribution that very much match with observations, not just in the local universe, but also going out in redshift. My interest is in trying to understand how some of this messy physics works. I should say I'm not one of the people that does much of the modelling. I'm more about trying to observe the radio sources and come to understand how it is that the radio AGN do feed energy into their environment, and to try to observationally test whether the amount of energy that comes out of radio AGN activity is the right amount that we need. So to try to understand some of the messy astrophysics that we put into the model. And in the local universe, that does seem to work. The amount of energy that the radio AGN put into their environment is the right amount that we need to stop the gas from cooling. That's what recent observations show us.
Bringing us neatly on to the next topic, which is your involvement in LOFAR. You are the scientific coordinator for LOFAR. Tell us a little bit about LOFAR.
Well, so the scientific coordinator for the UK part of LOFAR. LOFAR is the Low Frequency Array, which is a new radio telescope that's being built in the Netherlands, but with extension around Europe to other countries, including the United Kingdom. And we have a project called LOFAR UK, which is concerned with building part of the LOFAR array here in the United Kingdom, and I'm the scientific coordinator for that project. A LOFAR is a new type of radio telescope. It's not like the traditional dish telescope that you might see out at Jodrell Bank. Rather, it's just a collection of wires and tiny dipoles spread in fields across the Netherlands and now across Europe. And these are then connected together by incredibly powerful computers. And the main, with a software telescope, the dipoles can image essentially every dipole sees the whole sky at all times. And the trick is in the computation and in the software to then correlate these together in such a way as to make images in certain directions. And the limitations are essentially only set by how fast you can transfer data from each station to the central correlator and how quickly you can correlate it all together. I mean, in principle, with a powerful enough computer and fast enough data transports, you could image the entire sky continuously at all times. In reality, computers aren't that fast nowadays. The main correlator in the Netherlands is a BlueJean computer. It's one of the fastest 10 computers in the entire world. And we can image reasonable areas of sky, maybe 30 square degrees or so, but not the whole sky at once.
LOFAR is an interferometer. Yes. Now, we've got radio interferometers already. What's different about LOFAR, apart from the fact that you can observe the entire sky, although we can do that with other interferometers as well? What's different about LOFAR?
Okay, so two things are different about LOFAR. Firstly, it works at low radio frequencies. Most of the current interferometers we have work at much higher radio frequencies, around a gigahertz or a few gigahertz, some maybe a little bit under a gigahertz. LOFAR works down in the regime between 30 megahertz and 200 megahertz. This is a very new area of the universe, and we expect some different astrophysical phenomena going on there. There are some particular parts of astrophysics one can only observe at these frequencies. For example, Jupiter is a very much a low frequency emitter, and the Sun. So if you want to do solar system astrophysics, you really need to go to low radio wavelengths. We can't do it with high radio frequencies. But one of the other main things, as well as opening up this new window on the universe, is simply the fact that we can image such large areas of sky with LOFAR. This makes it a fantastic instrument for very deep, wide surveys, but also as a monitor of the sky for any transient phenomena, things that go off and come on and go off rapidly, like maybe pulsars or supernova gamma ray bursts. So it's going to be very exciting for those.
In the context of solving the problem, or at least refining the answer to the problem about AGN feedback and the galaxy luminosity function, how will LOFAR help?
So, as I said before, locally in the nearby universe, we've been able to do studies that show that the amount of energy coming out of the galaxies in the form of radio sources, the radio AGN feedback, if you like, is the right amount to prevent cooling. But galaxy formation didn't mostly happen in the nearby universe. Massive galaxies formed at much greater distances, higher redshift, back when the universe was only perhaps a third or a half of its age, is the peak epoch of star and galaxy formation. It's also the peak epoch of AGN activity. So we can see that the radio sources are, if you like, retaining the massive galaxies as being old, red, and dead without any much ongoing star formation or gas accretion. What we really want to understand is how this worked at much earlier cosmic epochs. So when did this radio AGN feedback really begin to become important, and how did it work at high redshifts? And this is one of the things that LOFAR will be great for, because what we need to do this is very much deeper and wider radio surveys than we've ever been able to carry out before. And LOFAR is going to, with its wide survey capabilities, it's going to open up a revolutionary new window for doing this.
If LOFAR is going to be a deep survey and it can presumably see out to the redshift values that you require, why do you need such a large area survey?
Okay, so there's two reasons for this. Firstly, obviously, the wider area that you survey, the more sources that you will detect. And if you want to get very good statistics, and this is what we need to sample sources at all different radio luminosities at high redshift, then that's what you need. You need enough galaxies, enough radio sources to do this. But perhaps more fundamentally than this is the fact that the universe is made up of all these dark matter clumps that grow and clump together. And these clump together on many different scales. We've talked about them clumping into galaxies. But on much larger scales than this, they also clump together perhaps into large clusters of galaxies, where large halos of dark matter all form together and many galaxies form in the same region of space. And in other regions of space, they're what we call voids, where there's very low density of the universe and there's not much galaxy formation going on there. And the typical scales for this to happen, typical scales at high redshift, is maybe on the degree or so scale. So if you want to observe a fair sample of the universe, you really need to be covering many tens of square degrees. If you only observed over the small survey areas that are possible with other radio interferometers, fractions of square degrees, even if you took many multiple fields, you could by chance be picking only regions with clusters in it or only regions with voids, and you can never be sure that you're sampling a fair region of the universe. Particularly if we want to look at how these feedback processes depend upon environment. Are they different for galaxies within clusters than from galaxies within sort of more field-like regions in the lower density regions? You really have to sample enough volume of the universe to pick out all possible environments that galaxies can live in. Back at a redshift of 2, when the universe was about a quarter of its current age, you need to be surveying about 20 to 30 square degrees as an absolute minimum if you want to pick up all environments. And that simply isn't possible to do to the required depths with the current generation of radio interferometers.
All right. What's the current status of LOFAR?
So LOFAR is under construction at the moment. It'll be, as with any interferometer, it's going to be made up of lots of different stations. In terms of a standard interferometer, these are all dishes, but with LOFAR, it's stations of dipoles. The first station has been operational since 2007, and it's made its first maps of the entire northern sky. But obviously with just one station, we can't go very deep, and the angular resolution is very poor. It's going to have in total about 50 or 60 stations in the end, and between a third and a half of those are going to be installed in the early part of 2009, and by mid-2009 it should be taking its first survey data, and the whole array should be completed sometime in 2010.
You mentioned that there might be some stations built in the UK. Where will they be?
Yes, so we have already raised enough funding for one station within the UK, and this will be located at Chilbolton, which is the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory land, midway between Oxford and Southampton. We're hoping to get at least another two stations. If we had two further stations, one will be located at Jodrell and one at Lord's Bridge in Cambridge. And we have a funding bid into the STFC, the Science and Technology Facilities Council, in order to try to get funding for those and also to try to get some technical manpower to solve some of the issues that involve working with at low radio frequencies.
Well, we wish you all the very best for that bid and for the research, which I'm sure LOFAR will be providing very soon. Thank you very much for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So that's an interesting interview that we had with Philip Best. And it's interesting to think that when you see the first pictures of the Jodrell Bank Observatory site up here in Cheshire, the first radio telescopes look very much what LOFAR is going to look like. It's an array of dipoles. Yeah. So it's just a field full of wires on sticks, pretty much. And it just happens to be that at these frequencies, LOFAR is going to be built out of these dipoles.
And interestingly enough, LOFAR also has some practical applications down here on the Earth.
Neil, what are they?
Well, they're currently using the sensors on the LOFAR array that are in the Netherlands to monitor the weather conditions in the fields that they're occupying, which they're sharing fields with potatoes. And so they're doing microclimate observations and helping the farmers to plan where they're going to put pesticides to attack potato blight.
That's fantastic. So we might see the first results from LOFAR in the Journal of...
I think there are already some out.
Potato Science or something.
Yeah,
really?
I think they've already got some publications out.
Never let it be said that astronomy does not have practical application.
And so from an astronomical gift to farmers to astronomical gifts for all of you, we have some suggestions for stocking fillers for the upcoming festivities. Nick, do you want to start us off?
Yes. Now, listeners in the UK who were listening to Radio 4 this morning, being the 15th of December, would have heard an interview with Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell about a book of poetry which she has co-edited.
Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell is of pulsar fame. She discovered the first pulsar in 1967.
Yes, that's right. She discovered pulsars. And by the way, if you are interested in hearing the story about how she discovered pulsars, do check out our June episode of the Jodcast when we were at the National Astronomy Meeting in 2007 in Preston. But that's not the topic right now. Jocelyn Bell Burnell has co-edited a book of poetry with Maurice Riordan called Dark Matter, Poems of Space. Now, this sounds like a fantastic fusion of astrophysics and poetry, two fields of human endeavour which don't seem to come together that often. So that's a possibility.
It is, and it's quite reasonably priced. Although we did check on Amazon just before recording this, and their delivery schedule would have it arriving after Christmas, so other booksellers are available.
So I thought that was quite a nice idea. Stuart, what else? What other gift ideas could we suggest to people for those present receivers, potential present receivers who are astronomically minded?
For the astronomical person in your life.
That's right.
Well, if people haven't already got one, I would recommend a planisphere. That's always good to know where things are in the sky. It's a card or paper disc that you can turn around and orientate for the time of year and for where you are, and it will tell you what you can see in the sky at different times of the night. And Philips make a very good one, which is available all over the place.
Hmm. So a gift for yourself or for those people who just want to get out there and perhaps their New Year's resolution is to get out there and learn about the stars. A planisphere is a great start, isn't it? It's pretty much...
It is.
It's got a see-through window or a hole on the top layer of these two discs stuck together, and underneath there are the star maps.
Yep, you can even make your own. There are plans on the internet you can download and print out, and then just use a brass paper fastener and attach the two discs together, and you can make your own.
That's pretty cool. Oh, one thing we have to point out, though, is that they're usually specific to a latitude.
They are.
So if you're up here in the UK, for instance, don't send a UK latitude planisphere to your friends down in Australia, because that...
Well, you can send one. They won't be able to use it very well, but...
It'll be a little bit confusing, let's say.
It will.
So it's a good idea, though. It's a nice one.
For anyone who's starting out in amateur astronomy, it's two very useful things to have. One would be a red LED torch.
Mm.
That helps you keep your night vision. If you're outside at night and you need to look at your planisphere or your star chart or whatever, if you have a red light, it helps keep your night vision and stops it being taken away from you.
Yes, it's a common mistake that people make when they go out for the first time with a star chart of whatever stripe, and they want to start looking at the stars. They look at the stars for a little bit, and then they turn their torch on, look at their map, and next thing they know, they're dazzled for the next 15 minutes while...
Exactly, and then you can't see the Milky Way if you're lucky enough to be in a dark enough place to see it.
I used to use a bicycle lamp, just a red bicycle lamp. That was one.
Yeah, that's what I tend to do, actually. Mm.
However, they're getting quite bright, though, because they're designed to stop people crashing into the back of your bike. So, these ultra-bright red LEDs might be back to the same problem. So,
and my second suggestion is a woolly hat.
A woolly
hat. Fairly simple, but it keeps your head warm, and it does get very cold if you're out observing at night, especially if you're quite far north or quite far south.
Mm. Or even during the summer, the night times can get quite cold. Nothing puts you off doing real observing than a head cold.
Yeah, and thick socks, actually.
Mm.
Or no, they don't put you off observing.
No, no. It depends if you wash them or not. And a thermos. I've often found that, if you're out there 4 hours at a time and you don't want to go back inside the house for a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, you don't want to ruin that night vision you've developed over the last hour or so, then a good thermos of steaming hot beverage of your choice.
Yes, a nice cup of tea.
A nice hot cup of tea.
A nice relaxing cup of tea. I have to get those lines in there.
Excellent. And there you are, there are some simple and inexpensive gift ideas for the astronomer in your life.
Okay, so let's move on to the feedback, and we've had 4 reviews on iTunes this month. We had a review from Rupees42, from Greg Windsurf B, from Falray, and from Bransby in the US, who gave us a really nice review, and they're my favourite person on iTunes this month.
Thank you very much to everybody who's listening to us via iTunes. And if you do listen to us via iTunes, please do review us on iTunes and give us your rating. Send us feedback.
It really does help.
Feedback coming in from the website. Many thanks to Danny Schrader, Raymond Schultz, Sue Wesson, and Sean Mulcahy, who writes that he is looking forward to the next 12 months. Many thanks, Sean. So are we. And feedback from Facebook. Thanks to Dave Hine and Dave McIver. Stuart, you have Twitter feedback.
Yeah, we had a couple of comments on Twitter. One from Jamex UK, who said that we made a mindless attack on computer programmers in our intro.
Did we?
At the last episode. I think that was one of my lines.
Well,
that Dave gave me. It's not my fault, honestly. And we also had a comment from Sackett J, who wonders whether we have a descendant of Newton's apple tree somewhere around Jodlebank 2.
Hmm.
Now, we're not quite sure about that.
I'm not sure about that, but we certainly have a lot of apple trees in the Arboretum. It's part of the National Collection of Marlis. So we'll find out for you. We'll have a apple-themed episode coming up, hopefully with the answer to your question.
Well, as long as people download that to the iJod.
The iJod.
And, of course, we've had feedback via the new forum. A few people have signed up to the forum already. We've currently got 27 members of the forum.
Yes, so hello to everybody there.
And people have already been starting a few discussions, talking about the supermassive black hole at the centre of the galaxy, which mm-hmm. was announced on the European Southern Observatory press release this week. Some great observations there.
Yes.
We had a comment from Rev Aaron, who misses our elaborate intros and outros, but he did leave that comment just before we had the last pantomime. So
to everybody out there who are listening and who have not joined the forum, do remember this is your forum. This is your opportunity to contribute to the Jodcast and discuss things which we mention on the shows or anything that's been bugging you, questions, comments, or discussions that you'd like to start. There are a lot of people who are reading the forum, I'm sure, who haven't joined yet. So please, it's a simple matter to register and contribute.
And if you do join up, please add a comment to the Introduce Yourself discussion thread. We like to know who people are and say hello to everyone else who's on the forum.
Yes. So apart from the forum, if you've got any feedback you'd like to send to us, do remember that there's a number of ways that you can do it. You can send us your feedback via the website at www.jodcast.net.
You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
You can check out the Facebook Jodcast group at jodcast.net/Facebook or just search for Jodcast on Facebook.
You can join the new discussion forum, as we already mentioned, at forum.jodcast.net.
And you can catch up with all the videos on YouTube at youtube.com/Jodcast.
And that just leaves us to say thank you to Philip Best, to Fiona Thrail for editing the intro and outro, and apologies to Clement Clark Moore for horribly abusing his poetry.
Until next episode, Merry Christmas, be safe, be happy, and we'll talk to you January.
Jod on.
Jod on.
And then, in a twinkling, I heard at the start the swift introduction of each little part. As I drew in my head and was turning around, on came the listener feedback abound.
With postcards and notes written on our Facebook wall, and emails and news from the forum and all. Then on to the interview, onwards with Perk, to listen to scientists talk on their work.
And ask an astronomer, and all of the banter, delivered to me as if by old Santa. So many more things that I'd like to know. They'll just have to wait to the next Jodcast show.
I listened and laughed with the hosts, banishing all of the Christmas Eve ghosts. The cookies and milk I had left filled my belly, and shook when I laughed like a bowl full of jelly.
But then all too soon was the end of the issue. A tear filled my eye, and I reached for a tissue. For now I knew well that I now had a while for the next show to make it to this stellar file.
And then to my joy a memory stirred, the Jodcast's in video as well. Oh my word! Bite-sized astronomy knowledge right here, enough there to keep me informed till New Year.
I sprang up so joyful and booted the net. The issue thus finished gave me such regret. But as I can see all the shows on the site, happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night.